and gentlemen, welcome to the most electrifying must-listen-to podcast in sports entertainment. Welcome to FFC. I'm your host, Damian Ellinghouse, accompanied as always by good friend and lover of doing the same thing over and over and over again until you get it just right, Ryan Doyle. How are we, Ryan?
How are you, sir?
Well, I'd be better if this wasn't our third time fucking doing this, but here we are. The important thing is we're here and we're together.
You gotta keep them on their toes, man.
Time to tell Ryan the same story that I just told him. Gonna break the fourth wall a little bit, talking out of kayfabe here.
Where'd you go?
I went upstate with my fiance. It was nice. It was a road trip. We went all over the place. We spent Father's Day with her father, which was a train wreck. And then we saw a bunch of other pretty things and waterfalls and mountains. And it was just nice to get out of the city because the city is terrible and awful. And
smells you fucking talking
death.
About my hometown like that?
Yeah, I sure shit am.
Yeah,
sure
why don't you go live in, I don't know, Lawrenceville, wherever you're from.
Yeah, go live in Idaho, you schmuck, yeah.
Hey, fucking potatoes over here.
Oh, look at this guy over here, not liking the bad place he lives in. Oh, fucking...
What, prick. You like nature? Huh?
Nature.
You're
I got nature? I got your fucking nature for you right here.
How was it, man? How was it? Did you see any good waterfalls?
We did, yeah. We went to Letchworth State Park, known as the Grand Canyon of the East. I also saw a little waterfall that... I feel like is a nice hidden gem, which is cool about New York, that there's so many hidden gems.
Is it in Ulster County?
Is it in Ulster County?
Yes.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't know if you've ever... I don't know. I don't know if anyone's ever heard of it. It's called Niagara.
Oh. Is this some little Indian waterfall I never heard
yeah,
of?
Yeah, some little schmuck waterfall fucking... bouncing around being ridiculous. Yeah, I was took Gina to see the Niagara Falls. It was very cool.
Very cool. I've actually never been there yet.
It was my second time and it was awesome. Really, really nice to go back and see it. New York is fucking beautiful, man. If you're looking to take a trip somewhere and you live in New York, consider staying in state and just like travel around upstate. It's so fucking nice.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we always joke around how like, you know, anything past the Throsnick Bridge is upstate, but you know, we live in a state where you can go 8 hours and still be within it. So, I mean, go explore. It really has a lot to offer.
I literally drove like over 1,000 miles on this trip.
Yeah, that's crazy. You don't think, I don't know. You don't think it's that big where
yeah.
Our world down here is so small.
You don't think about it, but it's a great state. Saw a lot of Confederate flags, though, which was... I always
dude, listen. Upstate New York is the South. I've had this discussion with many people. It's just,
I always think it's
Mechanicsville. Did you ever go to Mechanicsville?
I might as well have.
Bro, you go to fucking Suffolk County, you see Confederate flags.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, one time I went to fucking Wilkes Bar to go see Title Fight on their 10th anniversary with my buddy, and they played like Bounce and Composure and Super Heaven before they changed their name to Super Heaven. I forgot what they were before that. And just fucking Confederate flags and ATVs all over the place. And that shit's always funny because you're so far from the Mason-Dixon that it's like you don't even get to use the Southern heritage and pride argument. Like, you're just a racist. That's it.
Yeah.
That's what you are. You're just like, listen, slavery, not so bad. You know, not so bad. That's how you feel. So,
yeah.
But also saw a fair bit of Black Lives Matter stuff, which was cool.
Hey, there we go.
It wasn't all gloom and doom in this room. So, you know, overall it was nice. I recommend people get out of the city. And, you know, it's in phase three, but me and Gina really tried to stay away from people as much as possible because, you know, the pandemic's not over. Stop fucking thinking it's over, right?
Just, it's over, bro.
It's over. Open it up. Open
Scam-demic.
It up. anyway,
stay safe out there, everybody. We're not out of the fucking woods yet. I mean, let's just hope that we can all stay in New York. I think we're down to like 160 cases a day, but like we just hit fucking 35,000 throughout the entire country. So,
yeah, it's really not a good time.
It's sad.
It is. It's really fucking sad. And Anyway, you know, we got loosey-goosey episode today, but some stuff I'm really excited to talk about. But real quick, just wanted to take a quick minute. We put something up on the Twitter today, but just wanted to reiterate. It's been a hell of a week for wrestling. Between the WWE having over a half dozen, over two dozen positive cases of COVID-19, and more importantly, the speaking out movement, in which women and men in the wrestling world, but of course predominantly women, are coming out and talking about the various ways that they've been sexually harassed, abused, taken advantage of by promoters, by talent, by backstage people. And, you know, it's, I don't want to call it heartening because it's so fucking sickening that so many, like, every woman, you know, has had an experience like this. You know, not necessarily every single person has had the same experience, but if you have a woman in your life, ask them and they will have at least a couple of stories that'll make your fucking skin crawl. And wrestling, especially, this reckoning has been coming a really, really long time. Wrestling was really lucky, and I don't say lucky in a way that should be meant to be taken as positive, but like, wrestling's lucky it escaped the Me Too movement at its peak, you know, because it's just carny bullshit no one cares about. But I'm, for one, really happy that people are finding strength to speak out and call people out on their names. And I don't want to give pieces of shit too much of our time, but you know, people like Joey Ryan out here talking about changing the landscape of wrestling and feminism and intergender matches, and you know, you're exactly the fucking sleazeball that you're saying your gimmick is. And just countless fucking people, so many people. I really, really hope that this is the start of a new era in wrestling. I hope that the old boys club fucking dies a real painful death. It was too long coming. And to anyone that's spoken out, know that you are incredibly brave and you have all of our support. And for those of you who haven't been able to speak out or don't wish to speak out, you're no less brave or strong for being able to survive what you survived. And to everyone who hasn't been outed yet, your fucking day is coming. So count your chickens.
Yeah, I mean, dude, it pains me when we have to talk about certain topics on here, and it's happened like thousands of times where we'll bring up a certain individual or just a certain time of wrestling. And like, we have to talk about it with like such heavy, like, burdens on our souls because how awful some of these people, some of these characters were in the industry. And if this industry truly wants to survive, you're exactly right. They do need to take down the old guard. It's not that simple sometimes though, because you have individuals where, you know, I hate to say it, maybe we should have looked at the dick flip guy a little more in depth. But sometimes it's the people you least expect, man. And it's horrible. I personally never went through anything like that. I certainly hope, you know, nobody has taken actions considering that of myself. But wrestling needs a change, dude. You know, I mean, scandal after scandal after scandal, they're not going to be able to survive another generation. If they persist on having these attitudes and, you know, acting in a certain manner, excuse me. But, it's troubling, man. It's heavy. This is the last thing that we needed during this time.
Absolutely. And, you know, but this is always how it's been throughout all of society. And this industry is no fucking different. But if anything, it's a little worse because that old boys club has been around forever and it's strong in wrestling.
It's
and,
strong.
You know, like I said, you know, we have to be able to do our part, right? And the people who have spoken out need our support. And so on a Twitter, put up a couple of resources if you or someone you know has gone through this, and a couple of organizations you might want to consider donating to. And you know, I hope wrestling really gets its reckoning, and I hope this shit sticks. And just remember, whoever your favorite person is, right? Whoever your favorite guy is, the guy that you grew up loving, the girl you grew up loving, don't defend shitty behavior. Because no matter how much you love their in-ring work, no matter how much you love their promos, no matter how many good stories you've heard, if they're pieces of shit, they're pieces of shit. And you can't let people's work in the ring overshadow that. And this is not acting. This is not music. This is people dealing with people on a day-to-day basis. And so, you know, we'll stop our soapbox here, but I just wanted to make a statement in support of that because I think that people need to lend their platforms to important issues like this, you know, just like with the Black Lives Matter movement, just like with any form of civil rights movement. So you have our support.
Arena's a good foundation to donate to. There's a lot. I just want to make two more points and then we can just move on. Damien always brings up a good line, and it's kill your idols. You know, these people aren't real people, most of them. I know the lines have been blurred over the last decade or so, but like these are still characters to an extent, and you need to separate the art from the artist. It's hard. I understand, you know. I mean, there's certainly plenty of wrestlers that I love that are immensely pieces of shit, and, you know, I still revere to this day, and it's hard. But, you know, that's what you got to remember. And I don't know how you feel, but I remember 4 years ago, we started seeing, you know, the seeds being planted for these movements. And they were met with either just complete disregard, or they lasted for a while, and then they kind of went away. But life comes in waves, and, you know, we are experiencing the tide pulling in and then coming crashing down again. This certainly is not going to be the last time it's happened to.
100%. I absolutely agree. And look, man, it fucking sucks. All right. Shawn Michaels is my favorite wrestler growing up. Imagine fucking hearing that shit. Well, you don't have to imagine, because I was hardly the only guy who fucking loved Shawn Michaels. And when you hear the shit that comes out, you're like, well, that's not great. You know, it's like finding out that the shit with Stone Cold wasn't just the work. It's like finding out about all of the fucking thousands of stories about Ric Flair, about hearing the bullying stories about JBL. It's just hearing stories about fucking Vince. It is how it is. And exactly like you said, they're characters. They are nothing more. You know, you can't let that get in the way of people that need to face reckonings. And, you know, that's what I got to say on it. I don't want to spend too much time on it, mainly because I think that the people that deserve to talk are not us, but I want to make sure that we are making our support clear and provide a platform for those people. And so we'll try to move off the heavier topics now. So Ryan, yes, what are you drinking? Because obviously I'm drinking.
Not fucking Miller Lite, so.
Are you sure?
I'm fucking sure. I'm sorry I did that tired-ass joke the last couple weeks. It's been a long fucking 3 months.
That's okay.
Anyway, I finally had the great opportunity to go to Ghost Brewery in Bayshore. Which I was surprised to find that it's in conjunction with Great South Bay. It's in the same building. I'm not sure if they're still owned by each other.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Ghost Brewing Company. Fucking awesome. They came out, I want to say last year. The guy was part of Brickhouse Brewing, and he went off and started on his own. Okay. And they have a lot of great beers. Tonight I have Mischief Maker, the Belgian double IPA, clocking in at 7.6.
Ooh,
We got some Azaka hops, some Jerry Low hops, some Vienna, some Carahel, and some flaked wheat.
Okay, all right. Sorry, please go on.
I also have another one.
Oh, saucy Ryan.
I have the Afterlife Kentucky Common, and this bad boy's clocking in at 5.8, brewed in a Kentucky whiskey bourbon barrel with chocolate and cherries.
I've had the pleasure of having that one. That one is great.
Right, yeah.
Ghost is one of those breweries I discovered on Tap Room. And, you know, not an advertisement, but if you want to sponsor us, that'd be just fine. No, Ghost is great. I dig him a lot. So I also have two. One of them, everyone will be probably pretty familiar with, Pile Chinoffa Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, the gold standard of American pale ales. Arguably one of the most, not arguably, one of the most important beers to the American craft beer revolution. Not the first. I think technically the first is usually given to Anchor Liberty Ale, but brewed in 1980. I only mentioned this one really just because the people can't see, but can you see this label?
Yep.
Do you notice it's a little different?
I do. Did they change the location?
So it's the original 1980 packaging, and it says...
Oh, sick.
They give a little story about how, like, the labels got printed all washed out and fucked up, but they couldn't do anything about it because they didn't have the money. But honestly, I like it better. It's like this lighter, rainbow, very colorful label, and it's
right.
I don't need to tell the people what Sierra Nevada Pale Ale is, but it's probably one of my, if not my favorite beer of all time, and probably is your favorite brewery brewmaster's beer as well. No, but the important one that I have here, you hear the thing that my voice just did? That was fun. This is by Aurora Brewing Company in King Ferry, New York. I brought back like 50 beers from upstate. Just hit a lot of breweries. This is the Passion Fruit Mango Ghost Face Killer. It's a ghost-style ale with Himalayan pink sea salt and coriander conditioned on passion fruit and mango. And this little sucker here is clocking in at 6.6%. So,
ooh.
I haven't tried this one yet.
Demish.
So, I will crack. Oh, you get hit with the aroma.
I'm cracking the Kentucky, by the way.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Yeah. If anyone ever goes to Ithaca, I highly recommend it. And if you drive up Lake Seneca and Lake Cayuga on the Finger Lakes, there's breweries all over the place. Great place. Great, great all around. Yeah, this is a great beer. Okay, so, ladies and gentlemen, the king of sports is back after the scourge plague COVID-19 eliminated almost 3 months of Puroresu from our lives, with the last event being held on February 26th and resulted in the death of the Wrestling Dontaku, Wrestle Dynasty at Madison Square Garden in August, which we were going to attend, and the Best of Super Juniors. New Japan Pro Wrestling is back in glorious silent fashion with the New Japan Cup. I am so excited. I make no apologies for my blatant fanboyism, but I have missed New Japan Pro Wrestling, and by God, am I happy to see it back. The New Japan Cup represents the other half of the two most prestigious annual tournaments in New Japan Pro Wrestling. The other, of course, being the G1 Climax, which will this year be held in September. Thank God it's being held. And, like its counterpart, it is an openweight tournament in which the winner has received a title opportunity at any belt of their choosing since 2006. And they receive that at the Spring Event Invasion Attack, which is now known as Sakura Genesis, or sometimes known as the Spring Showdown at Ryogoku. And open weight, just in case anyone doesn't know, just simply means heavyweights and juniors both in the tournament together. Unlike its counterpart, however, the New Japan Cup is a single elimination tournament and is therefore seen as significantly less grueling, as a winner will have a maximum of 5 matches throughout the tournament if they were to win, while the G1 requires a minimum of 9 matches from every competitor, with an additional match should you advance to the finals. No less spectacular, however, and certainly prestigious, if seen as not necessarily as prestigious as a G1 win. This year's iteration is unique in that it represents, to my knowledge, the first empty arena shows in New Japan's history, bringing them into the glorious year of 2020 alongside their North American counterparts. Unlike their counterparts, however, New Japan did not hold any shows until Japan had lifted their state of emergency on May 25th, and up to this point, President Harold Meiji had been very clear that they would not be risking fans nor wrestlers' health until they could be sure that they were able to conduct shows in a safe manner. They paid their staff and talent throughout the crisis, and in general, they took a very slow approach to their return, with Mage saying, "To hold even empty arena matches in these circumstances would reflect badly on ourselves and our industry, and we will not trade our reputation as a positive force for social good, even in the wake of harsh economic realities. It is the goodwill that we have fostered within our audience, our partners, and society that led to Wrestle Kingdom 14 this year to become a great success, allowing us to continue operating in the black. That goodwill must be protected at all costs." Can you imagine that, Ryan? A company that feels that if they treat their employees with just a modicum of respect, they might get some loyalty back and, like, maybe people won't hate them that much? Stunning. Truly.
Sounds like some communist shit.
Yeah, I know. tanky dames over here. Don't get me wrong, right? I'm not here to drink the Kool-Aid. I love the company, but it's a company, right? This is not done entirely with goodwill. And I'm not here to blow people for doing what they should be doing, right? But it is worth mentioning because this is in stark contrast to WWE, who notoriously were listed as an essential business in Florida, where the Performance Center is located, and have been repeatedly reported on as doing basically nothing for safety since the outbreak began. They didn't do much more than get rid of the fans, not particularly by choice, and taking temperatures, usually, sometimes, which led to superstars such as Roman Reigns, Sami Zayn, Kyle O'Reilly, and more recently Kevin Owens to stop attending tapings altogether, which WWE said they were fine with, and then stopped being fine with, apparently, because we stopped mentioning Roman Reigns as a fucking member of the roster. While the WWE also brought in Ric fucking Flair and Jerry Lawler to showings.
Dude, how are they going to do that? I know Rick would, like, die in the ring if he had to choose, but, like, dude, the man, like, literally almost died last year. Like, was it necessary to bring him in for a promo?
For what? For, like, Randy Orton Edge? Don't get me wrong, cool match, but, like, the fuck are we doing?
Call spade a spade. I mean, like, New Japan is, like, the diamond in the sea of shit, but, you know, I mean, unfortunately, the aspect of it is that if AEW stops running shows, that's it. So, I mean, from a business aspect, from the industry aspect, I get it. It's hard.
I just, you know, and, like, the whole thing is, like, it's not like this shit exists in a vacuum, right? Up to this point, positive cases were limited to backstage personnel. However, it was recently reported by Ryan Satin that numerous backstage people as well as on-screen talent tested positive during tapings, over 24 people. Notably, Renee Young, who, you may or may not know, is married to fucking AEW champion Jon Moxley, which created ripple effect in which Jon Moxley was then taken off TV for the foreseeable future. 24 fucking people are reportedly positive. Coming off the heels of the return of a limited fan base to show in cases in Florida skyrocketing due to Governor Rick DeSantis being a walking bag of human excrement stitched together and given life by some unfeeling and cruel god. He's basically the fucking Oogie Boogie of governors.
Rick Scott, their senator, is a fucking shitbag too. He ran one of the biggest Medicare fraud schemes in America. No surprise there. And they are suppressing the number of cases in their own states. So.
Because, you know,
hats off.
I told my people, stop testing, please. Keep the numbers down. Fucking Jesus Christ. You know, and I get it. I know what it sounds like. Oh, yeah, fucking FFC hates WWE. But honestly, I mean, this, we're not talking about fucking bad booking decisions. We're not talking about Baron Corbin being on TV too much. We're talking about human fucking lives in the middle of the worst health crisis in over 100 years, and they weren't even testing people. They weren't even fucking testing the people showing up and sweating on their goddamn screens on top of each other, bleeding. It's like unreal. It's unreal how cavalier it is, and you can't even be fucking surprised because it's WWE. And you're like, yeah, they just don't give a shit. It doesn't matter. It's
infuriating.
There's
no words. There's really nothing worth to say. They won't even let the people wear masks if you're watching the audience, by the way.
Like, it's infuriating. And I feel I'm very animated about this because, as people may or may not remember, I'm a social worker and I work with the medically frail. And I work across the street from Mount Sinai Beth Israel, where I literally walk by a trailer of human fucking bodies every day. Like, every day I look to my right next to Stuyvesant Park, and I see that the street is closed off because they have a fucking fridge there for the bodies. It's, you know, so the cavalier, the callousness of Vince McMahon, it never really, it you always find another level, another way to be disappointed. And AEW, right, they've been equally as active as WWE. However, it would appear that they have taken a much more serious approach to testing on-screen and backstage personnel, with superstars such as Hangman Adam Page, Evil Uno, and Stu Grayson, the Young Bucks, MJF, and more being given the green light to stay home until they felt comfortable returning, even at the expense of active storylines. And with the broadcast team and Tony Khan making sure everyone sees the brightly colored wristbands on the talent's wrists, showing that they had been tested and cleared by medical personnel. And as far as I've been made aware, that is the deal. I still think there's arguments to be made about whether Cody should be fucking blading himself in the middle of this and bleeding all over himself. And, you know, also, again, to contrast to New Japan, who was straight up like, yeah, we're not doing it. Like you said, AEW, I guess I get it. But also, you know, you are backed by billionaires and, like, you probably could have given it a little bit of time because they also fucking run their shows out of Florida. So, yeah. I don't know. It's hard, but it's just interesting how different the responses have been, you know?
WWE has a decision to fall back on, like, old Raws, and I guess they could show pay-per-views of their choosing in place of these events. With AEW's case, I think it really comes down to their TV deal because TNT is not going to, they don't have a back catalog of shit, and TNT, they'll fucking replace them with American Dad reruns if they have to. But, you know, I was just curious, if they ran an old Raw with, like, Stone Cold and, like, The Rock facing off at the end, do you think they would get better ratings, honestly?
I don't know. I do know that people really didn't like that they were, like, showing entire matches, like, from WrestleManias and shit. So, I don't know. It does also feel like the fan base doesn't really know what it wants, but I just feel like at some point, you know, Dave Meltzer always makes the point that, like, WWE's never made more money. And as I read just now from Harold Mage's quote, like, they directly attribute being able to make that decision as being because of how successful Wrestle Kingdom 14 was, and that's not even with a TV deal. So, like, you really could just take a minute. And, you know, there's a lot of internet sleuths out there that are like, oh, TV deals, you'll be in contract of this. But, like, we don't fucking know what the contract says. We don't. It's Vince McMahon. Vince McMahon has had a deal with USA since 1983. So, like, do we really think they're going to, their ratings, you mentioned this a couple episodes ago, literally they pull in ratings that you get for, like, Sunday Night Football. And that's with the product being terrible. Like, who's going to get rid of that? You know, even AEW, like TNT, where's TNT going to make up getting that much viewership? They're not just going to make that up out of nowhere. You know, they're getting almost a million people a night. So I don't know. I'm not even saying, like, it's reckless to run a show necessarily. Right. I just do think that you can't go about it the way WWE did, and AEW seems like they dealt with it a little better because you don't really hear these stories. You don't really hear this shit. At least cover yourself. But, you know, I don't know. Anywho, I'm soapboxing a lot tonight, and I'm sorry. I'm a glass case of emotions. Right. The first New Japan event held since the outbreak was the Project Together special on June 15th. Featuring all the factions and tag team action, including some very fun action between Los Ingobernables de Japón and Chaos, in which Naito debuted a brand new move, as well as the announcement that the New Japan Cup would be held starting on June 16th and would end on July 11th at Osaka Joe Hall, which will be the first New Japan event with a live audience and where the winner would go on to face Tetsuya Naito for both the IWGP Heavyweight and Intercontinental Championships the following night at Dominion, which is also held at Osaka Joe Hall, and it marks the first time that Naito will defend his championship since facing Kenta at New Beginning way back in January. And as one last thing, it'll be the first time in which the new Japan Cup winner will have a chance at both belts in one night.
See, isn't it nice to actually get real wrestling matches and real wrestling events when you wear a fucking mask?
I know, it's a beautiful thing. And I should put a little asterisk there, because technically the first New Japan event that was held was back in May, and it was somewhere in San Francisco. It was a closed doors event. The wrestling promotion that they worked with at the time escaped me. But, you know, Jeff Cobb and a bunch of Gaijin were there, as well as at other New Japan talent. But it was, reports have it that it was like insane with how strict they were with their regulations, like disinfecting the ring after every single match. No one was coming in or out. And, you know, even now, they've kept a lot of that with, when you watch these events, there'll be an intermission where you can literally see them, people in hazmat suits. I think it's Young Lions in hazmat suits, just like spraying down the ropes and stuff. But
what do you think it was for? Do you think it was for a rundown of the U.S. promotion that they're trying to start up, or?
That's possible. I think it was like the guy that they worked with is like a guy that New Japan's been working with. Like I said, it's a promotion people would know, but I don't know it off the top of my head. But I also think it was probably a little bit of a test balloon to see how they would do things and how things would work. And they've kept a lot of these things now, like the locker rooms are staggered. They kind of keep backstage conversations very brief. They don't have like the buffet out. They have a lot of things that I can't speak to the individual backstage practices of like WWE and AEW, but they're really stringent about it. And it's interesting to kind of run your first show in America of all places right now, or even back in May.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it goes to show that, you know, they want to make sure they can keep their talent safe. And once they figured out how they would do that, now we can run the cup shows.
Yeah. And I mean, with the tournaments, they're only having 20 people on the show at a time. So,
yeah, like there are some people in the audience, which I thought they were completely empty, but.
I think they could do like, as of right now, they could do about 25%.
I think it's way less. More. I saw like five or six people just up in the crowd, and like they're telling them to not make noise, which is kind of interesting.
Oh, wow. I thought I read a report that at least for the final, which is 2 weeks from now, they were trying to have at least 30.
No, yeah, you're 30%. Correct. Like I said, July 11th at Osaka Joe Hall, I think they're trying to have a third capacity. Osaka Joe Hall, I believe, holds 15,000, so they'll have 5,000 people. And now that's a big enough crowd, they'll probably tell them, you know, you can make noise. Like, it's going to be interesting to see it with, like, that many empty seats. But still, that's going to be, as far as any wrestling fan is concerned, the first show with any sort of sizable actual crowd. I don't know if it's open to the general public or if it's friends and family or executives. My guess will probably be somewhat general public, but maybe you have to be rich enough to afford it, that type of thing. Businessmen, yeah. CEOs, mm-hmm. That sort of shit. But that's going to be a trip. And that is tick-tocking along. And so, obviously, because of everything going on, you know, there's a lot of talent that's not going to be there, right? This is notable in that the only gaijin there are going to be Zack Sabre Jr. and Gabriel Kidd. Due, of course, to travel restrictions and other complications from the pandemic. And as such, some holes have needed to be filled with the loss of talent like Jeff Cobb, Will Ospreay, Jay White, Colt Cabana, Kenta, and others who were all slated to be on the card. Kenta is, I think, because Kenta might still live in Florida, if I'm not mistaken. Ospreay is interesting because I remember Ospreay making a big deal out of moving to Japan at some point, either when he won the Junior Heavyweight Championship or when he defended it right before Hiromu challenged him. So maybe that just never materialized yet.
You gotta wonder too, with everything going on, if he would have still been on the show.
Yeah, I don't know when these cards, I don't know when the new brackets were made, and whether, because Ospreay's whole situation between him, Bea Priestley, and Pollyanna happened like years and years ago, and so it's nothing new. But
yeah,
they might have seen the writing on the wall and been like, it's maybe we just don't do this. And I didn't know that Zack Sabre Jr. lived in Japan. Now, despite the lack of talent, don't think for a second that this is a second-rate production, as the fact remains that you're still going to have six of the top 10 wrestlers with all-time wins in the New Japan Cup in Hiroki Goto, Hiroshi Tanahashi, Yuji Nagata, Togi Makabe, Kazuchika Okada, and the true ace of New Japan and the master thief himself, Tori Yano.
Fuck yeah.
Now, Tanahashi was the inaugural winner in 2005. Goto is the all-time winningest competitor in New Japan Cup with 3 tournament wins and 23 total wins, while Okada has the highest winning percentage at over 90% and has won 2 of the 3 tournaments he has entered thus far. He has like a 10-1 record coming into this. He was also the second winner to ever turn the tournament win into a championship at Sakura Genesis after Yuji Nagata defeated Tanahashi for the IWGP Heavyweight Championship in 2007. And he is the only person so far to have done so twice. Interesting thing about Tanahashi is Tanahashi, when you're looking through the results, right? Because he won the cup in 2005, and this was 2 years after his rise to stardom, and Tanahashi is now like the, at that point, he's the ace of New Japan. He doesn't necessarily win all the New Japan Cups or get to the finals, everyone, but he's involved in almost every single title match because, you know, he's an 8-time IWGP heavyweight champion, and his reigns are so historic and long and storied, as many IWGP heavyweight championship reigns are, that he's just fucking everywhere. There's just like a block of a decade where every single title event involved Tanahashi or Okada in some form.
Now, was it, how is it, I know it's a little different with the Japanese crowd, but how was it received over there when someone is in the title scene so many times like that? Because it could be sort of like a dual-edged sword here. You know what I mean?
Japan needs an ace, right? Like a Japanese promotion always, and like every wrestling promotion needs an ace, right? In the NWA, you had Luthez, right? You had Hulk Hogan later on in, you know, WWF. Like every promotion needs an ace. Roman Reigns currently, Ric Flair in the NWA. But New Japan especially, their reigns, like old school NWA reigns, they tend to be over a year. They are long, and they only defend the belt maybe 4 times a year, so it's a big deal. And Tanahashi is so important to New Japan's modern history and like its resurrection from the brink of bankruptcy that no one really cares. Same thing with Okada. You know, Okada and Tanahashi are still so wildly over. If you just ran a show, every event was Tanahashi and Okada for the IWGP Heavyweight Championship, you'd probably sell out every single one.
Yeah, I think, you know what it is? I don't think we just ever had any figures like that in a while. In WWE, at least in this context.
No, yeah, for sure.
I mean, the way you're phrasing it to me is pretty much like they were just Shawn Michaels and Stone Cold, like they can't be touched. There's no discussion whether or not they're being propped up or that they're giving opportunity after opportunity. They're just larger than life, and this is just the way it is.
And this is, of course, through our current lens and us as Americans. I wouldn't be shocked if the Japanese got sick of it at some point or like if there was a segment of the population. But as far as I can tell, having a really strong ace matters a lot more than like variety. And of course, you want different challengers, but being the ace is kind of with the understanding that no one who challenges you is going to win. Like aces always go over the biggest events. They always have great showings in all the tournaments. They're strongest. They're always booked strong as shit. There's not a ton of 50-50 booking. Gato does it a little, you know, he likes to have people get their wins back, but it's not nearly as big a deal. And Tanahashi and Okada, between the two, are responsible for some of the biggest, if not the biggest, gates in New Japan history, and by far their most profitable margin, more so even than the 90s. Even when you had Muda and Hashimoto and Shono and everybody running the show there. So they're extremely beloved. And I think that we as Americans kind of look at it like Okada is an interesting example, right? I wouldn't necessarily say that Okada is the best at any one particular aspect of wrestling, but he's such a complete package of everything that you need to be a good wrestler. He's charismatic. He's got fiery promos. He's got a good move set. He's a great seller. His facial expression, his in-ring psychology, he does everything so well that even though you wouldn't necessarily call him the greatest athlete or the greatest bumper or the greatest anything, all of it comes together to make him this perfect package. Same thing.
I was saying they emanate a style, which is like, it's something that isn't honed in enough on the current product around the world, frankly. I forget what it was. I think it was a Naito. The first time I ever saw a Tanahashi clip, it must have been in like 2007. And either Naito finally beat Tanahashi or Tanahashi beat Naito. I'm not giving the correct circumstances here because I'm a noob. But I took one look at Tanahashi. I was like, dude, look at that hair, man. I was like, fuck you. Who is this guy? I got to find out more about him.
Mm-hmm.
And then pretty much I remember someone just straight up told me like, yeah, this is pretty much like the Shawn Michaels of New Japan right now.
Absolutely.
And, you know, like I said, I don't think we have like we don't have any larger than life people right now, you know, aside from like a handful of people, of course. I'm not gonna disrespect anybody. I mean, the New Day certainly when they were at their peak, they were larger than life. Daniel Bryan probably another one, but Daniel Bryan still like gives off like the everyman type vibe, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. Much in the same way that someone like AJ Styles does. And right. I think part of that is because, you know, the differences in the promotions and the way that Americans do things versus the Japanese, mm-hmm. versus Mexico versus any other place in the world. But Tanahashi is somebody that it's hard to find a direct comparison to Tanahashi because you would have, I don't know, probably the best thing you could think of would be, I don't know, you know, NWO coming to WCW, but like WCW wasn't exactly floundering. They just weren't the top company in America. Like Tanahashi is in a lot of ways considered to be solely responsible, along with like giving Gato the books and Inoki stepping down. You know, Tanahashi is the guy seen as responsible for New Japan being anything these days, let alone easily the biggest Japanese promotion. You know, there was a time where All Japan was way bigger than New Japan, a time where even Pro Wrestling Noah could have vied for that role. And so WWE, WWF, WCW, it's all a little different because those promotions didn't have that type of savior who changed the entire way that everything worked. You went from Inokiism to Tanahashi, this flashy, flamboyant, charismatic dude dressing up in sparkly stuff with this long hair, air guitaring around and jumping off stuff. He just hearkened to an era that had not been seen for so long and was so different than anything that had come before. It's hard to think of a one-to-one comparison, and I think that's why he has such a long leash and such longevity to this day.
Stone Cold, coming in after the 95 era of WWF?
Yeah, probably, you know, because Stone Cold or like The Rock were people that transcended the sport in a way no one else really has ever been able to. And Tanahashi is very similar. Tanahashi's when New Japan does things for the government, Tanahashi's the guy going there giving speeches. You know, he's the guy, he's the ambassador. He's on TV, he's everywhere. So like Stone Cold and The Rock, probably The Rock a little bit more than Stone Cold, probably the best comparisons. But again, WWF wasn't exactly about to collapse when they showed up on the scene.
Yeah, but it was like a dead era, you know what I mean? They were still going through like the occupation gimmicks and all that shit. I think I like your example of WCW a little better when NWO first came up. Because like, you know, like I said, they weren't about to lose that money, but then that just fucking put a firecracker up their ass and shot them up.
Absolutely. And I guess to be fair, when The Rock and Stone Cold really like broke out on the scene, WWF was losing the Monday Night Wars, and as we spoke about some episodes ago, you know, that era, were it not for WCW shooting themselves in the foot, probably WWF could have gone under, or at least no longer been the top brand in America. So yeah, they're probably the closest comparables. And so that's why you see in this era of history, it seems like every match and every Wrestle Kingdom is him versus Shinsuke Nakamura, him versus some of the old legends, versus Tenzan, you know, and then later on, him versus Okada, over and over and over again, just with such classics, you know. And then to move off of, you know, Tanahashi, because Tanahashi is, you know, everybody knows Tanahashi, you know, if you follow. But, you know, Hiroshi Tenzan, he's in the New Japan Cup this year. Four-time IWGP Heavyweight Champion, 12-time Tag Team Champion, as well as a three-time G1 Climax winner, tied for the most ever. Yuji Nagata is a two-time IWGP Heavyweight Champion, who is the only Triple Crown Tournament winner in all of Japanese wrestling, meaning that he won the G1 Climax in New Japan, the Champion Carnival in All Japan, and Pro Wrestling Noah's Global League. As I mentioned, Tanahashi is Tanahashi. Minoru Suzuki needs very little introduction as well. But all of this is to say that there is a dearth of experience and veteran presence in this year's tournament to complement some of the younger guys, such a, and I say younger guys, I mean, obviously these guys have been around for a while, but, you know, Kota Ibushi, Zack Sabre, Shingo, Takagi, Ishimori, guys that are obviously younger than everyone else. But there's a lot of experience in this tournament. And as we've seen up to this point, these guys can still go. And this is a tournament where there has been a pretty healthy mix of established stars and up-and-comers who have won or gotten to the finals. Traditionally, it leans a little bit more towards veterans. You know, Tanahashi was already the ace by the time he won, or at least was almost there. Nagata had been active since the 90s. Hirooki Goto was already kind of in his prime when he started winning. But then you have some younger guys as well, like Zack Sabre Jr. that have won in recent years, or Kazuchika Okada when he broke out on the scene. Kazuchika Okada had just broken out when he won his first cup.
Just taking a look at the old bracket versus the new bracket, it almost seems like this kind of works out better for the New Japan product. I mean, granted, you want those bigger Gaijin stars and Kenta, obviously, but it looks like they're giving opportunities to young lions that rather probably wouldn't have not gotten a spot, and older guys too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in a lot of ways it also works out because the guys that are in the bracket, they're not nobodies, you know? Yuji Nagata, Blue Justice, Hiroshi Tenzan. I mean, you're talking about guys that have been around forever for a reason. They're top guys, you know, and they're older now, but as we're going to go through, I mean, they can absolutely still go as long as they got the right guys going with them, and sometimes in spite of it. So me and Ryan made brackets. Now I had the incorrigible Shingo Takagi winning the entire New Japan Cup, and Ryan bet boldly on Kota Ibushi, who, if memory serves, is a one-time winner. Now, Ryan still has a shot. I was kicked in the face, so I do not. So, you know, I don't need to go through every single match, but going into this, Ryan, what were some of your expectations for what we were going to see?
So, honestly, when I was making this bracket, I kind of had the philosophy going into it as if it was like the G1. But then looking further into the New Japan Cup, I realized like this is pretty much more or less given an opportunity for like up and comers or like a first time opportunity. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, like I said, the winners have been like a healthy mix of both, but the only shocker that's really ever happened in New Japan Cup history was Giant Bernard winning. Who do you know?
Albert.
Albert.
Yeah. Fucking
yes,
crazy.
Sir. Albert ran through and won. I think the second ever. Outside of that, though, I would say that it's a little bit of a toss up. But you usually get a more established guy. But by no means does that mean it's only older guys winning.
Right. So when I went through, I'm going to be honest with you, I didn't know a lot of, not a lot, but I know a couple of the names. For example, I had to look up Tsuji.
Mm-hmm.
Should I have known Tsuji?
I'm no expert myself.
Uemura, who's a young lion.
Uemura is a young lion. Very
kind of looks like he could fit in with Inoki in the 70s, honestly.
Very much so, and I believe the company is quite high on him, and for good reason.
Yeah, honestly, most of the other names I knew. Should we talk about the upset?
Yeah, so, well, what I'll start by saying is the reason that I picked Shingo to win, and I picked Shingo and Hiromu Takahashi duking it out in the finals, is not necessarily there hasn't been an angle where LIJ is going to blow up, but LIJ is in this interesting place where, kind of, I guess, similar to Bullet Club under AJ, and then especially when the Elite came on, LIJ, everyone's a big deal. They nearly have every single belt there is to hold. You know, Shingo, current never open weight champion, as well as, I believe, never open weight six-man champion. Naito, of course, being double champion. Hiromu Takahashi being junior heavyweight champion. And Evil being, along with Bushi, the other members of the six-man championship. Sanada is the only one without a championship. I kind of thought he was going to beat Zack Sabre for the Rev Pro Championship at Wrestle Kingdom to complete the roll call, but the storyline seems to be that Sanada might be breaking out soon, right? Takahashi's always been a little bit on the other side of Tranquilo, a little bit of a loose cannon. He is the time bomb, after all. And Shingo, having stepped up from the juniors and just, you know, he was already a little bit of a legend in Dragon Gate, and now being in New Japan, you know, he's not exactly a very young man, but certainly prime of his career and ready to take over. So that's why I suspected one of the New Japan, the one of the LIJ guys would win.
Yeah, so full discretion, I randomly just picked this one. And when I went to Squared Circle on Friday, everybody's like, if you had show winning, you're fucking lying. And I just like quietly raised my hand. And I was like, yeah, I did.
Yep.
But the only reason why I really had that is because I looked at the ages between the two and I took a shot in the dark. And I saw that Shingo was skewing a little older. So I figured that, you know, they're going to run with the younger guy.
Mm-hmm.
And plus I have show losing to Sanada anyway in the next round.
Mm-hmm. And
just because I know, well, I'm personally high on Sanada, but I don't know what there's rumors of him going over here. So I don't know if this is like a final shot for him or.
Sanada is very over. I mean, Sanada's had multiple matches for the IWGP Heavyweight Championship against Okada. He pinned Okada in the G1. It's a huge deal. So Sanada is honestly a pretty good bet to win the whole thing. And, you know, I should have done a little more research because Sho and Shingo have gone at each other for quite some time, because Sho is also seen as a little bit the powerhouse of the juniors, which is what Shingo has also been seen as since breaking out in New Japan. And Sho's kind of whole thing with Shingo has been he hasn't been able to beat Shingo, and he just can't seem to one-up him. He can't seem to out-muscle him. And so this was a good way to set up a match for the Never Open Weight Championship, give Shingo and Sho a feud, elevate Sho a little bit, continue to have Shingo bring prestige to the Never Open Weight belt. And also, if you're going to have him lose, this is a good time to lose. So maybe you knew
it's
what you
were kind of like 1-2-3 Kid and Razor Ramon.
Yeah, you know, maybe you knew what you were doing the whole time, and it's kind of one of those things where it's like, oh, I would say that Sho is a little more over than 1-2-3 Kid, though. He's okay. I mean, he is current junior tag team champion
does it have an opportunity to open up the floodgates for wrestlers like Sho, as that match did kind of with cruiserweights?
Oh, sure, absolutely. I mean, the whole thing with the Never Open Weight Championship is that juniors and heavyweights alike fight for it, but this is a way for Sho to show that he can be more than just the strong guy in the juniors division. So a couple of matches that really stand out that I highly recommend people go and watch. And there have been a lot of really good ones. You know, Ishii versus El Desperado on the first night was a terrific, terrific match.
Can you provide some background for me for El Desperado?
El Desperado is a member of Suzuki-gun. He was most recently, and he tags regularly with Yoshinobu Hanamura, who you may know as the guy that does the mist, but with whiskey. Desperado wears a mask, right? Like Bushi, kind of comes from that lucha styling. Not overly flashy, but very good in the ring. And they were recently IWGP Junior Heavyweight Champions. I think they most recently lost it to Yo and Sho, Roppongi 3K. So I don't know if there's a ton of history outside of that between him and Ishii. I'm sure there is, you know, Ishii being a member of Chaos, Suzuki-gun and Chaos being separate on, you know, Chaos is now kind of the face faction. Suzuki-gun is not a face faction. So they've met plenty of times, but I don't know if there's more bad blood than that. But it was a great match, really, really great match between a junior and a heavyweight. The match of the tournament so far is going to go to Yuji Nagata and Minoru Suzuki, in my opinion. Have you had a chance to watch this match?
Nagata and Suzuki?
Yes.
Yes, I did.
Day two?
Yeah, day two. I was able to catch it.
Absolutely brilliant. Now, these two have both been active since the 90s. They have had countless run-ins with each other. However, in the ring, they had only met one other time, I believe, when Suzuki tapped out Nagata. So this was, and this was a huge upset. I had Suzuki beaten Nagata, as a lot of people did, but Blue Justice went over Murder Grandpa on this one. And this match was hard-hitting as all hell.
Should I have been surprised by that?
Well, Suzuki is a guy that he can win or lose basically any match and will never lose his standing in the card. Suzuki can be a six-man champion or fighting for the IWGP Heavyweight Championship in the blink of an eye. Although, funnily enough, he's never actually been IWGP Heavyweight Champion, which is very, very curious. And at this point, I don't know if he ever will be.
Well, you know what's interesting? Amongst like all these guys, he definitely has a following here in the States. And I know that doesn't really translate to their product over there, but I mean, like for someone of his stature and his age to be over as much as he is, and granted, he's fucking awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, for this stage in the game, for him to be over here in the States and around the world, you know, I don't know if they're going to give the title to him, but I think that would be fucking awesome if they gave him a run with something.
He most recently faced off against Okada for the heavyweight championship. He's been Intercontinental champion before. He's been Rev Pro champion, I believe. He's been never open weight champion. And I would listen, I'd be happy to see it. Suzuki is a great guy outside of the ring, and he's just got a brilliant mind for the sport. And he's just really well respected. And this match was probably the best match of the tournament so far. I really highly recommend people go and watch that. A couple other matches that stood out to me, Sho and Shingo, huge surprise. But like I said, there were some people that were like, you know, if you like pay attention to Gato's booking enough, like this makes sense that Sho would go over him here. But really terrific match between two smaller guys that are just strong as all hell. That was on night three of the quarterfinals. Kota Ibushi and ZSJ had a great match. Hiroshi Tanahashi and Taichi was a terrific match. Taichi is a guy that's a little bit divisive to fans. He was kind of a guy that just didn't do anything for a very long time. So him going over on Tanahashi, A, sets up Dangerous Techers, which is the team of Taichi and Zack Sabre Jr., to take on Hiroshi Tanahashi and Kota Ibushi for the tag team champions, which they are now setting up actively. And also
techers as in like technicians.
Yeah. It's like a British term.
Techers.
Yeah. ZSJO is, oh, these techers, beautiful techers. Outrageous Tekkas. So that was a very good match. And then night four was fine. It was nothing like stood out. So at the quarterfinals end, Ryan and I stood pretty close. I had gone 12 for 16. Ryan had gone 10 for 16. My entire bracket on the right side, of course, was now shot because Shingo was not going to go anywhere. Ryan still has a chance, though, because Ibushi is alive and well, baby. The semifinals, which happened on the 24th, were outstanding from top to bottom, in my opinion. Taiji Ishimori, the Bone Soldier of Bullet Club, who I love, took on Yoshinobu Hanamaru. And something that I didn't know is those two have a very long history together that I think dates back to Pro Wrestling Noah. They're both like in their upper 30s. And they went to war with each other all the time. Ishimori actually never beat Hanamaru throughout their entire career. So this is the first match he's ever beaten him over, I think at least in singles.
Does New Japan reference that? Or they don't really, like, you know, like if I fought you in TNA in 2003,
yeah,
it, like, WWE probably won't mention that. Well, they'll mention it in like a sense of like, you know, they're old rivals from back in the day, but like, does New Japan reference other promotions like that? Or it's kind of just like, nah, we're not going to give them the time of day.
That's a great question. And honestly, one that I'm not entirely sure of the answer for, because for example, Suzuki-Gun a few years ago when ZSJ joined was exiled from New Japan and they went over to Pro Wrestling Noah in an invasion angle. It's always referenced that they were exiled. I don't know if it's referenced that they were exiled to Pro Wrestling Noah.
So it's kind of like up to the viewer to fill in the plot holes.
But entirely possible, like, I don't know what Japanese commentary says.
Yeah, that's true.
And the English commentary right now, they just have Moro. Jesus Christ, Moro. They got Kevin Kelly doing it a few days later, so I don't know if they mention it or not. I'm sure they probably do something similar. All these guys go way back and may even reference that Ishimori never won. But outside of that, I'm not too sure. Makabe and Tomohiro Ishii went at each other in a really, really great hoss match. Those two are often on the same team together anyway, so that was a lot of fun. Hiromu Takahashi and Toru Yano, right, was so fucking funny. Great antics all around. Yano pulling out a pair of clippers because his whole thing is like, I'm going to shave off Takahashi's hair. Red Shoes takes the clipper, or maybe it was Marty Asami who takes it away, only for, and then like Takahashi gets it, tries to turn it on, it doesn't turn on, only for Yano to reveal that he had a second pair of clippers the whole time. Really just excellent antics, and
I love that, man.
Worked so well. And in the main event was Yuji Nagata versus Kazuchika Okada, who I believe have faced off before, and that match was absolutely terrific. Interesting thing about Okada is Okada, with his two wins through this tournament, has not actually hit a rainmaker.
Interesting.
He has won both of his matches with the Cobra Clutch.
Now, there's a move I did not expect him to not necessarily have, but like utilize as a finisher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not necessarily the greatest Cobra Clutch you'll ever see, and people on the internet don't like it a lot, but it's interesting because the story that seems to be being told is that Okada just is like, well, why would I don't need the Rainmaker. I'm not even in front of people. Like, I'm not going to use the Rainmaker. Like, you're beneath me.
I like that.
So when Okada does bust out the Rainmaker, maybe against Ishimori in the next round, so it should certainly be interesting.
No, that when you phrase it like that, it's a lot better, but it kind of sounds like him doing that is kind of like when the Rock does the sharpshooter.
Yeah. You know, it's mockery because Okada's the ace. He's the face, but he's an asshole.
Now, let me ask you a question. Is he like, I'm not going to do the Rainmaker. I'll do whatever move I want. Here, I'll just do the Cobra Clutch. Or is there like a kayfabe reasoning for behind it? Because believe it or not, The Rock does the sharpshooter because he has a kayfabe connection to the hearts.
So
as it goes.
Is that right?
That's right, because Brett trained. The hearts are very good business partners with Rock's family.
Oh, with the Maiveas?
Right. So they trained in a camp together, and story goes that Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart came over to do a promotion for The Rock's mother, and Shawn was an asshole, and that's why Shawn Michaels and The Rock never really squared off.
That's very interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah, but Bret, you know, made sure that the landscape was set up for The Rock to flourish, and they've always had like a, you know, a good friendship. So I think that's why he was allowed the opportunity to do the sharpshooter.
Well, I don't know the exact reason why the Cobra Clutch is what was picked. However, I believe that it was used in a storyline with Naito back when they were feuding originally, is that like Okada was using it against Naito.
Cool. I'm gonna look that up.
So there's some history, but I don't know why specifically it's the Cobra Clutch. And so the matches that we're going to have next, right, you're going to have Goto versus Evil, should be fun. You're going to have Yo versus Yoshihashi, which will be a match. You will have Sonata versus Sho, which should probably be great. Ibushi versus Taichi, which will be very interesting to see. You'll have Okada versus Ishimori. And you will, that'll be the night after. You'll have Okada versus Ishimori, and you will have Ishii versus Takahashi. So we're really getting to the meat and potatoes of the tournament. And something that really stood out to me in this is we've complained a lot, as most wrestling fans have, about how integral it is to have an audience. But honestly, New Japan is doing a really fucking excellent job, and it's the way that their matches go. The commentary teams, either be it Kevin Kelly or be it the Japanese commentators, which are notoriously loud and very energetic, as well as the wrestlers themselves, the silence you're used to in Japanese wrestling rings because of how quiet the crowd tends to be. And even those huge moments where you would expect noise, it doesn't seem as weird because of how energetic commentary is, because of how loud the wrestlers in the ring are. And there's just a little bit of a different ambiance. And it's really nothing against the American stylings. It's just the way that, you know, who could have ever fucking been like, oh, you know, we should really try to be loud in case we never have an audience in front of us at a wrestling show.
No, right. And this is where, you know, I kind of like, I might be the unpopular opinion on this. I kind of like the Performance Center shows just because it gives like that studio old school vibe to Raw. Is it translating well to a product? Not really. But you see where the crutch is with American wrestling is that they rely on the audience as a live laugh track. And, you know, because they don't have that, it's like you're watching Seinfeld without the audience.
And it's funny that you mention it in terms of like laugh tracks, right? Because Yano's first match against Jado, which was awful because Jado can't fucking move, is Yano is a guy that really feeds off of the audience as well, and the audience is very receptive to him, and so his antics don't always translate as well without an audience behind him. But when you have somebody who's as charismatic and funny as Takahashi, it just works, and it's money.
Right. You could feel the energy too. And I mean, you know, not every match is working out to be like this, but, you know, just from the American's perspective, you know, when we watched, the Funhouse match, we knew where to laugh. We knew where to, you know, pop to. So I think, you know, as long as the wrestler knows and is smart enough to harness that and execute their moves and what they do character wise in the ring like that, they won't have a problem.
Oh,
and
yeah.
A lot of Japanese wrestlers are masters at that.
Absolutely.
Also, another thing is that, you know, we always kind of joke around, but the crowd in Japan, they're not like hyped up 24/7. They have like a strategic, like polite clapping at the beginning, and then they rise up. You know, it's interesting. Nick Lee of Moontooth, friend of the show, also plays in Riot, and they go to Japan a lot. And he said the crowd would be going fucking bonkers during a song. As soon as the song has ended, everybody just remains silent and politely waiting for the next song.
Yeah, plenty of musicians have told tales about that as well. So yeah, it's just this particular, unique, historic circumstance happens to lend itself much better to Pyoresu than it does anything else. It, Japanese crowds wrestling as a whole, it's just a little easier. The crowds are not quite as trained. It's not, it's just, it's different. And so it works a little bit better. And, you know, even though brackets are made, you know, if anybody wants to send in their suggestions for who they think's going to win, or play along with us, certainly feel free to shoot us a line on Twitter, or send us emails.
Yeah, we still got a good chunk left, and, you know, our bracket's kind of like messed up here and there, but if everything goes correctly, the semifinals should be near perfect for me and Damien. So if you guys want to play along,
please,
let's do it. And hey, listen, I, like I said, full discretion, I went in this pretty much blind, so, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, say I know what's going to go going to go down. But like I said, if everything goes correctly, we're going to be in for an awesome, awesome semifinal and final.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's just nice to have New Japan Pro Wrestling back. And, you know, that's really what there is to say about that for now. You know, I'm stoked to see what happens. And not to ignore the other things happening. I know Elimination Chamber, or Extreme Rules, rather, is supposed to be like this Sunday, but considering that WWE is on fire, I have no idea what their plan is for that, and so I don't really feel like there's anything worth plugging outside of there's a contract signing for Drew McIntyre and Dolph Ziggler and Asuka and Sasha, which should be a great match. But also, fuck WWE, so I don't know what we're doing.
So, you know, they put a horror story tag to it?
Oh, yeah, that's right. They did. And, boy, is it not apropos.
Like American Horror Story, right? They use the same fonts and everything.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Okay, I don't know how that's going to translate. Yeah. Maybe, you know, I think probably, if I'm guessing correctly, Bray is going to show up as the demon. Who knows?
Oh.
Who knows?
I think they're the just fiend, like, you're saying?
Yeah, like it's gonna eventually translate into that. Well, and they have something up that they'll do an American Horror Story type vignette or match like that, which would be pretty cool.
He's got a match with Braun. He's got a Wyatt like swamp match versus Braun.
Ah, okay, that's gonna be I'll check that out. He's been hitting home runs lately.
Let me know.
But yeah, everything's on fire at WWE, so yeah, if you want to watch it, I'll fill you in.
And then for AEW, they've made Fyter Fest into a free two-night affair this Wednesday, July 1st.
Very smart of them, by the way.
Yeah, and then the following Wednesday. No idea what's up with John Moxley, being that he cohabitates with Renee Young, who currently is positive for COVID-19, wishing Renee a speedy recovery. We like Renee very much. So no idea whether we're going to have his match. I believe he was slated to take on Brian Cage. So don't know if that's going to happen, but you will get Best Friends versus Kenny Omega and Hangman Adam Page, I believe, this Wednesday. You've got MJF and Wardlow against Jurassic Express, Cody versus Jake Hager, and some other matches that either haven't been announced or that I am not remembering currently. So some fun stuff happening. And the next New Japan event will be July 1st. That will be the conclusion of the quarterfinals, I guess. And then the next event after that will be July 2nd and July 3rd. Those will finish up the semis, and then July 11th will be our finals. So a lot of good stuff happening. And with that said,
oh, not to mention, yes, too, NXT has the Great American Bash.
That's right. I did completely forget about that. Yeah.
The main, what you need to know about it is, again, it's going to be Adam Cole versus Keith Lee in a
winner takes all match. Winner takes all match. Had a terrific triple threat versus Finn Balor and Johnny Gargano last NXT, which was really great.
Also, we're going to get Sasha versus Io, which is going to be great. And I'm trying to look up if anything else was announced.
Is it Sasha versus Io Shirai? I thought she was taking on Asuka. Is she doing both?
Well, one of the matches is Tegan Nox and Mia Yim and two other ladies. I'm trying to see who they are. Oh, sorry. Versus Candice LeRae and Dakota Kai. So that should be all right. We got Roderick Strong versus Dexter Lumis. All the kids love Dexter Lumis. You got Aaliyah, who's Robert Stone's new up-and-comer, versus Rhea Ripley. Ripley must join the Robert Stone brand if she loses. Good old-school match stipulation there. The aforementioned women's match. You got Sasha Banks versus Io Shirai. And then you got Oney Lorcan versus Timothy Thatcher. But I'm sure there's going to be, and plus the aforementioned Keith Lee, Adam Cole match. But you know what? Actually, now that I'm looking at it, fun fact about the Great American Bash, I went to the one in 2003 at Nassau Coliseum.
Oh, yeah?
And that is where the ever-famed, that's a great question, Shelton speech came from Vince. Have you ever heard that?
No.
So Vince was holding a press conference backstage. It wasn't a press conference. It was pretty much like an, just like a team meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And this is right after Benoit tragedy happened. And pretty much WWE was like, hey, listen, we're going to revert to PG soon. And Michael Tarver, who was part of the original NXT crew, raised his hand and said, Vince, I have a question. You know, I think I had to do something along the lines of like, you know, can we be Kitty PG or can we be like Simpsons PG? And Vince says, that's a great question, Shelton. And the entire locker room started dying, dude. Started absolutely laughing that Vince couldn't fucking recognize.
Oh, that fucking, thought, oh God. Yeah. That story. That's right.
He's like, what? Stop laughing. And like the fucking meeting ended. But actually that was the pay-per-view with JBL versus, John Cena in the New York Street Fight match, which was fucking shit. If that's PG, then I wish the rest of the PG era was like that.
Oh, good. Makes sense. All right. So with that, Ryan.
Yes, sir.
I have a legend killer for you.
Oh, the tides have turned.
Now this,
send him my way, my friend.
This will be a little bit of an easy guy, I think, and it's going a little bit off brand from what Legend Killer normally is, but it's a great, I'm interested to see if you can point this stud out.
Okay. Is this Suzuki?
No, it is not Minoru Suzuki.
It's not Minoru Suzuki. Is it somebody of Suzuki's age?
Younger
as of right now. Okay.
Although if you've never seen a picture of Suzuki, he really was a little bit of a spitting image of Inoki. It's
so that was going to be mine to send to you this week, which I know you would have gotten in like 2 seconds. But he does look like a young, like he looks like the son of Inoki before, and then he got like corrupted.
Yeah,
the way.
Corrupted Inoki.
Damn, dude. All right, I'm going to do one final guess. Does he have a beard now?
He sometimes has a little bit of a guy, but he doesn't have a full beard now.
Is he in the New Japan Cup? And this will be my last guess.
Yes, he is.
Yes, he is. Okay. Tenzin?
No. No, my friend. That is a young lion, Hiroshi Tanahashi.
God damn it, I was going to guess Tanahashi, but he kind of has like a...
Well, you should have.
I feel like an idiot, guys. See, he has such beautiful, like, you know, tan skin now.
And it's without the locks. Yeah. It's
right.
Seeing Tanahashi without hair basically makes him almost impossible to figure out who he is. And this picture is from Hiroshi Tanahashi as a young lion. Now, of course, so many words have been made on this podcast, let alone anywhere else, about Tanahashi's career and rise to stardom. So instead, I'll give you a little bit of a fun fact that this was after he graduated from the New Japan Dojo in 99. And he was known, of course, as one of the new Three Musketeers alongside Katsuyori Shibata and Shinsuke Nakamura, right? Had a big win over Scott Hall in 2001. But the thing that's interesting that I would like to tell you about is a few years after this, Tanahashi had a little bit of a situation in which he was stabbed in the back by a TV Asahi news reporter, Hitomi Hara. You see, the two had dated one another, but they met, and then Tanahashi tried to break it off, and then he got stabbed in the back twice. She later said that she was going to commit suicide and was charged with attempted murder and sentenced to 4 years on probation. Tanahashi, what's interesting about this is that Tana was already on his way to stardom. However, this is what led to a prolonged absence. And when he came back, Tana went full on into his current rock star persona that ended up making him the superstar that he is now.
So was it not that it was better for him to be stabbed by a scorned ex-lover, but, you know, if he didn't have that, would he be what he is now?
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure with all of his charisma and all of his magic making, I'm sure he would have been a star anyway, but this was just like one more. It's hard to know where he would have gone, but the fact that he was already really on the upswing and then he's out for a prolonged time and he's seen as a little bit of a folk hero and he comes back after being literally stabbed in the fucking back, definitely helped him out. And it was right after that that he ascends to the top of the throne for New Japan.
Gotcha. Okay.
So it's not necessarily cool. An old gimmick, but one final thing that eagle-eyed viewers or fans of New Japan may recognize is that young lions are notoriously hard to pick out because young lions are all given the same standard black trunks that Antonio Inoki and basically all old-time Japan wrestlers, New Japan at least for sure, would wear. And their move sets are all very similar because you're taught the basics, one of which is the Walls of Jericho, right? The double leg crab, as well as the figure four, right? Brain busters, all that stuff. So all the young lions kind of have the same move set and all dress the same. It's not.
Are they told to like not be flashy and like, you know, have like, you know, like a standard like $10 haircut?
It's basically the idea is and. It's not all, and the New Japan Dojo also was incredibly brutal, like really, really fucking brutal. A little less so now, but like especially in Tanahashi's day, like we're talking dungeon levels of brutal, maybe worse.
Like abuse?
Yeah, no, like straight up abuse. The idea is basically don't expect to come in here and just like do whatever the fuck you want if you don't have all of the fundamentals down and if you can't get yourself over being no one, then you don't deserve to be over as anyone.
I kind of like that philosophy.
But you see even in this, right, Gabriel Kidd, he's got his own personality. Uemura yeah. as well. Uemura, you know, build matters, all that kind of stuff matters, but you're kind of slotted into, are you small? Are you big? Are you, you know, you going to do submissions? What are you going to do? So a little bit of little interesting aside for cool. our galactic ace Tanahashi.
You stumped me, bud.
Well, listen, I had to make sure it was a good one if I had any chance at all. Because if it was anything else, you would have gotten it. And so as we wrap up here, what have we been listening to lately?
Well, first, I just want to give a special shout out to our friends Travis and Tom.
Yes.
Signing of Modern State Records, signing the Dallas Cowboys. Oh, I'm sorry, the Callous Dowboys.
The Callous Dowboys, yes. Good friends of the podcast, Travis Gentile and Tom Nolfo, longstanding members of the metal community and scene at large on Long Island, and stalwarts, got together last year, I believe it was, to create Modern Static Records. First big release that they had was the absolutely phenomenal Crux by Moontooth, local legends themselves, and just recently announced the signing of Callous Dowboys, who I think people will very much enjoy if you're into that kind of spastic Dillinger Escape Plan-esque stuff.
Yeah.
But they're not.
But they have a beautiful fusion of metalcore alongside of
yes.
it. And, you know, they really take both generations and you know, just make this absolutely chaotic, furious sound about it. And Die on Mars was their release last year, and we don't have to wait long for their next release, and it's gonna be on your friend's label, so what's better than that, right?
Absolutely, definitely make sure to keep your eyes peeled and your ears to the ground for that, and make sure to give everybody big old social media hellos. Have you been listening to anything else as of late?
You know, I've been kind of like going back in. I was listening to Alice in Chains Unplugged.
No fucking way. You stole my band.
Get the fuck out of here. Oh, okay. Well, hold on. Wait, were you listening to that in particular?
Or? No. I think we're listening to different eras, so it's okay.
So, yeah, no, I got into the whole Unplugged craze of the 90s, and it was actually pretty nuts. Some artists really took that show and made platinum albums out of it. Eric Clapton's Unplugged, which I'm not a big fan of Unplugged Layla, by the way, but that is still the number one selling live album of all time. And who else had platinum albums? I think Rod Stewart's Unplugged show was platinum.
Well, Nirvana
certainly.
Of course.
Yeah. Of course. But yeah, you know, I think it got a little played out during the 90s that everybody and their mother was doing an Unplugged show. But for that time, that was probably like the last like true music thing that MTV did and contributed to society. So, you know, it was just interesting to look back on.
I love the Unplugs. And if memory serves, I think that was not too long after Jar of Flies came out, which was Alice in Chains doing like a kind of softer, more acoustic based record. Yeah. And there are some really excellent fucking songs on there as well.
Oh, fuck yeah. I Stay Away, Rotten Apple.
Mm-hmm. I really love that album a lot. Alice in Chains, I guess I shouldn't really call them underrated, but when you think of the biggest bands of the 90s and like the grunge bands, you might mention them because you know who they are. But in my estimation, Soundgarden and Alice in Chains are my personal favorites. And Alice in Chains are just so fucking heavy. And it's really not, it's kind of not fair to even call them grunge. It's only because Layne Staley had that girl type thing that everyone did, but they were straight up heavy metal, much like Soundgarden. I fucking love Alice in Chains, man. Dirt is one of the greatest albums of the 90s.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think they were just Pearl Jam and Nirvana overshadowed them. And, you know, that's not necessarily by preference. I think, you know, the big four, and if you want to include Stone Temple in there too, which I would absolutely would, even though they kind of like had more of a California sound.
Oh, sure. Yeah, and that's not even counting, you know, Bush or Mudhoney.
Right. Nirvana had that, and like, you know, even the Melvins, who probably have more of an impact on the metal landscape, especially, you know, within the last 10 years than maybe even any of those bands did.
Kurt Cobain often said that the Melvins, like Bleach, their first album, was just a straight up Melvins ripoff album.
Yeah, I believe that. But yeah, you know, Nirvana was tied in with like the indie scene a little bit. Pearl Jam kind of like had that Americana, like kind of Springsteen-esque vibe around them. Mm-hmm. And then you had Soundgarden, which kind of went for a more progressive sound. And just Cornell stood alone, man. You know, his voice. I love Layne with all my heart. But I mean, like, you know, Chris Cornell was not of this world.
No, it's no comparison. That voice, Layne Staley is an incredibly talented guy. And to lose both of them is really, really shitty.
And, you know, the last point I wanted to make was that Alice in Chains was obviously rooted in metal amongst those four, probably the most.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know that necessarily held them down, but, you know, I think that whenever you have a conversation with someone in regards to grunge, you can tell the individual that is the Alice in Chains.
I would agree.
And I think amongst of those four, you know, you could kind of argue with Pearl Jam, even though they kind of had like their down period for a while.
Yeah.
I think the most passionate has to exist with Alice in Chains.
Yeah.
I don't know if you agree with that.
For sure. And so for me, I've been going back and listening to their post-Layne stuff.
Okay. Yeah.
Because I really, really like the albums that they made when they reformed. The Devil Put Dinosaurs Here is my personal favorite of the three that they've put out since coming back together.
Mm-hmm.
But the most recent one came out, I think, 2 years ago, Rainier Fog, which is solid. And the first one, Black Gives Way to Blue. William Duvall is the guy that joined in 2006 after replacing Layne, who had died in 2002. And I don't want to, like, disrespect him by saying that he does a great Layne Staley impersonation. And rather, what I'll say is he fits the Allison Chains, like Jerry Cantrell and Lane Staley's vocals work so well together because they're just different enough. And William Duvall does a really great job of filling that gap that not everyone could fit, because Lane also had crazy range. And really fucking love Alice in Chains' later work. They are just as heavy, but they kind of had this like renewed sense of melody and ambiance that's just really fucking great. And I can't recommend those albums high enough. So I guess this week what we're all listening to is just go fucking listen to Alice in Chains. Just go.
Yeah, plus William is an amazing songwriter too.
Yes.
So I think he brings that aspect to the band as well, which kind of like fits. And, you know, like Jerry will lay out the pieces of the puzzle, but William will put them in. And, you know, Mike Inez and, the drummer. Sean Kinney's a fucking amazing drummer, dude. Mm-hmm. Like all the ins and outs of the little fills he does, especially like on the Unplugged.
Yeah.
Unmatched.
Yeah.
But amongst those albums, Black Gives Way to Blue is probably my favorite, just because of what it represents. Like, you know, it represents a comeback of a band that probably wasn't supposed to exist anymore.
And a great one, 10 years after the voice of their band dies. I mean, who would have guessed?
Yeah. And on the title track at the end of the CD, you know who plays piano?
Who?
Sir Elton John.
Ooh, Sir Elton. That's nice.
That's cool, right? That's cool.
And one last shout out that I will give before we wrap up here is the last thing that I was listening to. I was bumping this the other night, was Lil Peep. In case I haven't mentioned before, Lil Peep, real name Gus R. I knew him, you know, when he was growing up in Long Beach. I was friends with his older brother, Oscar, and, you know, was lucky enough to watch his meteoric rise and unfortunately witness his tragic passing as well. And, you know, Christ, Gus was real talented, and everybody's got their thoughts on, you know, the kind of drug fueled emo rap, mumble rap stuff that, he and his peers would make. But Peep kind of stood alone in like having this interesting pop punk, like My Chemical Romance inspired edge to him, like this early 2000s emo punk thing. And it just worked really well. And he's a huge name at this point, but definitely worth checking out. He's also got a documentary on Netflix now that his mom and Oscar helped put together and helped set up. So, you know.
You know, I don't know much about him. I think certainly his impact on that culture is going to be a lot more of a mainstay than some of the other and some of his other peers in that genre.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sad he passed away, but, you know, better the burnout than the fade away. And he'll always kind of like have that moment in time about him.
Yeah, it's a shame he couldn't have more. And he was a great kid. And, you know, he's missed to this day. RIP Gus. And, you know, cherish your musical idols and people while you got them around. These are tough times. So that's what we got here today. The New Japan Cup will continue, and our next episode will possibly take us to the finale. So Dominion will be right there after, so we'll be chatting it up. Make sure to like and rate and subscribe and do the things, and you know,
hit that like button.
Tell us,
that little bell up top and the subscribe button.
Yep. Tell us what you like. Tell us what you don't like. Tell us something. Please, God, just fucking talk to us. We're so goddamn lonely. And for Ryan and for myself, this has been the most electrifying must listen to podcast in sports entertainment. This has been FFC.